So, Berto, I thought we would do an episode in which I just read a bunch of emails that people send in. What do you say?
That sounds like a plan.
Welcome to the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a licensed therapist and I'm a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I pick drafts for the NFL.
Interesting. So the first email came, I don't know, just a couple days ago, by a listener, Chrissy. She says, I am interested in psychology, and as I am learning English, I am looking for something both interesting and good to understand. You are explaining everything very well, and in addition to it, your voice is well-sounding.
Thank you!
So I managed to listen to this one in 2 days, and now I am eager to find some more to learn about psychology. Well, I'm glad for you, Chrissy, that you're both learning English and about psychology, and that I'm well-sounding.
You are well-sounding.
It is. It's better than...
It is.
Another email from listener Courtney. She says, or he, Courtney can be.
Yeah, that's both.
Yeah.
Courtney from, what's that band in the movie Dig?
Is there a Courtney in that? Was he the
guy? That's the main guy, the main singer of
what's that band?
The Dead Kennedys, the
I'll look it up.
No, don't look it up. God damn it. Don't look it up. Oh, it's a junkie like me, you know, this is killing me.
Starts with the Dandy Warhols.
The Dandy Warhols.
Yeah.
Starts with an M.
Courtney says, I just recently came across your podcast and I'm absolutely loving it! Exclamation point. I'm currently in the middle of your talk on Milton Erickson. I was into him as a teenager and uncritically accepting of his philosophies and practices based on his acceptance of NLP, or neuro-linguistic programming, which I also uncritically accepted. It is
as a teenager. Wow.
It is absolutely eye-opening to hear your analysis. Yeah, this is interesting. I get a lot of negative feedback or negative emails regarding my Milton Erickson episode. For those of you out there that aren't in the cult of Erickson, this will surprise you. You'll say, like, well, why would you get so much negative emails regarding Milton? Isn't Milton Erickson just one of those guys that, you know, that wrote books on how to do therapy, and among literally thousands of other people?
Right.
Well, the thing is Milton Erickson is involved in hypnotherapy. And so whenever you have something like that, you'll attract a wide variety of people. You also have this idea that you can control other people through different kinds of techniques. And so whenever you have that, you'll have a certain kind of person involved in that. Neurolinguistic programming has some interesting parts about it that are probably supported by evidence, but they also make a lot of claims that are not. And so what happens is you have the general science psychological community basically refuting a lot of the claims by Milton Erickson and NLP. And then you have the proponents of Milton Erickson and NLP fighting back. And they, in my experience, and I didn't know this going into this, can become quite defensive about things. So I've done a lot of episodes, and I look at everything critically. I look at myself critically. I look at Berto critically all the time.
What?
All the time. And the point of that is we should always try to best understand our situation. And one of the ways you do that is when you read something from someone is you just you take away what you can, but at the same time you try to put it in its appropriate place. And this is a book by Jay Haley, actually, whom is another person I respect a lot, wrote a book about Milton Erickson, whom I also respect a lot. And I critiqued this book. And I talked about all the good points of the book, and I talked about all the things that I personally use as a therapist from Erickson and from Haley. But I also called out a lot of things as well. I pointed out some passages that are really quite shocking and seem to me exploitative of clients and even potentially even sexually abusive.
Like the take your clothes off and all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Oh.
No. I've read about some of his, like, scandal stuff.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Interesting. That's surprising that you would even have heard about him.
You know why? It's funny. Like, I went through this period of doing a lot of online research on people that debunk stuff, like the great Randy, or what was his name? Randy, right?
Yeah.
The
amazing Randy.
The amazing Randy, yeah, yeah. You know, hypnosis always comes up. Like, can people get hypnotized? So I remember a little bit of that.
Interesting.
Like, the controversy about that.
Yeah. I mean, just for the record, hypnotism is a real thing and does work for what it has been demonstrated to work. Mm-hmm. It is not, has not been demonstrated to work in the way that people in popular culture understand it, where you have someone look at a watch going back and forth and then they go into a state and then you can make them do anything.
But that's how Looney Tunes presented it.
Exactly. The way that it has been demonstrated to work is that you can absolutely help people, because they have to be willing to go into another state. Their brain goes into another state.
It's like Arkansas or...
Like what?
Alabama or...
Right. Like an empire state of mind, if you will. Mm-hmm. Or it's sort of like if you were to watch TV for 3 hours without moving and you just stare at the TV and say the TV show is kind of monotonous, your brain would be in a different state at the end of those 3 hours.
Yeah, like Poltergeist.
Yeah. And if someone came to you and said like, hey, what's going on? It would take you a little bit for your brain to adjust to the mode that it normally is in when you're actually interacting with people.
Sure.
So that's all, and there's some therapeutic value depending on the situation that hypnotism.
If you've done like a sport, like a marathon or something, where your body is very very focused and maybe exhausted, and or if you've gone without sleep for a long period of time, right, you get into some weird states.
Right, meditation. You can absolutely go into different states, and in those states, there might be some possibilities that might not be as possible in your quote-unquote regular state. Anyway, so I talk about all that in the podcast, but another thing I point out is that throughout the book, it's story after story about Milton Erickson's success. You know, someone will come in and say they're afraid to get on the train. And so in 5 minutes, he fixes them by telling them, well, the next time you get on the train, walk backwards on the train. And then the person was cured. And it's story after story like that, where Milton Erickson and Jay Haley are both making the point that therapy can be 5 minutes. And I actually believe that. But
it's like the 1 minute manager. This is the 5 minute therapist.
Right. But the possibility that every one of those clients were successful 1 year later, 3 years later, it seems like a long shot.
It's also very micro, I've been in therapy. Anyone who's been to therapy knows that it's not one issue normally.
Right.
Like, that might be one thing, but what's that a symptom of? What else is going on in their life? Like,
right. Yeah. Whenever they do research on actual therapists, they find that, you know, they have a mixed results. They have mixed results regarding outcomes, which is natural because, you know, therapy is a very squishy thing. It's very hard to nail down in terms of exactly what to do. And some problems are not really receptive to therapy. But in this book, it was just, you know, hundreds of successes and no failures.
Yeah.
No even ambiguous successes. They were all just, you know, glaringly obvious successes. So, you know, I talked about that, and I get frequent emails. I put this episode up, I don't know, like 3 or 4 years ago. I get frequent emails telling me that I'm a terrible person. I don't know what I'm talking about. They call me out on my credentials. People on YouTube will say, like, who is this guy? He's not even qualified. And I'm like, I've been an educator in psychotherapy, particularly in family therapy, where Milton Erickson is one of the main figures, for the past 17, 18 years.
But that's not 25 years.
I've read a lot of his work, and I've read
not all of it.
I've read a lot of his critique, and I am a therapist, and I use his technique, and I've also read a lot of the research regarding outcomes, regarding his technique and other people's technique. I would say I'm a credible person to at least offer my opinion.
I don't know, man.
Right.
I don't know.
All right. So this person, listener Courtney, I greatly appreciate, because he or she is saying that he or she was drinking the Kool-Aid and then love the episode and love the fact that I was looking at it critically. Again, I will say for the you Milton Erickson-ites out there, I absolutely use his technique, but I filter it through my critical lens when I do it.
That's because you were hypnotized to do that.
All right. Another email from listener Derek. He says that he loved the Men Shame episode. You weren't there for that, the Men Shame. You were out of town or something.
I'm ashamed to have missed it.
I've got a lot of feedback, actually, on this episode.
Yeah,
people actually have stopped me at the university and said, I listened to that episode on Men's Shame. It really, they're all men, by the way. It really touched me, you know?
Yeah.
Which I didn't expect, but, you know, I think it's an untalked about thing.
It definitely is. There's so many symbols that we are presented with as we grow up, from books, from media, from our families, about what a man is supposed to be. And it's normally stoic, quiet, and brush it off. Get the up. You don't have problems. You don't. And you certainly, shame is not a word. Come on, get out of here with that.
Yeah, you're supposed to be unemotional. And that was one of the main ideas or things I was putting forth, was that I grew up myself having a lot of shame regarding crying and showing sadness.
Yeah. And my dad would get so angry at me if I didn't stop crying.
Right. And so I had to learn how to cry and have sadness as an adult. It was hard for me to actually, I actually set out to have access to an emotion that I did not have access to otherwise. And so it was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pressure when you're a kid to be a certain kind of man.
Right.
And to be tough and to be stoic and to always, you know, be cool and you know, this stuff.
But, well, and I gotta be honest, like, for a lot of our evolution, like, you know, I kind of probably wouldn't have been that useful out in the, you know, hey, okay, here comes the saber-toothed tiger. You're crying again? Dude, we gotta hunt. We need food. You know, it's like, I don't need you, like, whining about the saber-toothed tiger.
Well, that brings up another topic that I get a lot of emails about, which is evolutionary psychology. And I would say that, you know, that's a possible hypothesis that we could test, or actually we can't test because we can't go back in time.
Well, no, we can test it. You got to watch a football game and think about how much crying would help them in the running the plays.
But how would it not help? I mean, it wouldn't hurt them to cry.
It might, because it'll distract them and change their...
How would it distract them?
It'll change their hormonal levels. It'll make them see blurry. The other person will be like, oh, why are you crying, dude? Like, it's just not going to help the game. Trust me.
I'm unconvinced. The other thing is why would you be crying in the middle of a hunt?
Well, because you're feeling bad. You're hurt. You're telling them to go the other way. They're not listening to you.
Feeling any emotion in the middle of a hunt could be arguably distracting.
Sure.
Happiness, joy.
Sure. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So, or having, well, anyway, you can make the argument that emotion can get in the way of anything. You're picking berries. And emotion would get in the way of you picking berries.
But the men didn't.
But anyway, my point is that one of the things we look at when we look at evolutionary psychology is we look at other cultures. And men in other cultures have differing attitudes about crying throughout their life. And Americans have a particular attitude about crying that is not shared by other parts of the world. Now, I'm not going to dichotomize and say that America is on one end of one spectrum where they say you can't cry, and on the other end of the spectrum they say you can. But when you travel the world and you talk to people, you find that there's a lot of different kinds of attitudes. For instance, in other cultures, I know you can, for instance, wail and cry when you're mourning someone's death, but maybe not cry in another instance. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of different ideas culturally about what is acceptable regarding crying.
But there's also, you know, and you and I tend to be more on the spectrum of skepticism. I tend to be on the spectrum of, like, just look at animals, which is you look at an animal pack, and it is very deadly, literally, for the leader of a pack to show weakness. If they show the weakness, they in fact can get taken down. And a lot of times in animal structures where there's
which animals
an alpha,
are you talking about?
And any structure where there's like an alpha male, like a silverback or a lion, a pack, things like this. Whenever the alpha shows weakness, it is deadly for them. It can be deadly for them. Yeah, for them.
But not for the rest of the pack.
Well, I know, but then you would imagine, well, then selectively, the alphas tend to be the ones that don't show weakness.
Yeah. There's also arguments against seeing the human species as analogous to the silverback species. Because there's evidence that we didn't have that in configuration.
But then I would just check
the other thing is you only have one king and you have 99 regular people. So
no, not true. You have every family has a king. Every block that you live in has a king. Every city has a king. Every country has a king. And you see it today, dude. Whenever Obama says anything, he gets dissected, and if he shows weakness, he's thrashed, right?
But weakness is a cultural construct. Is crying weak? Not inherently.
But you know, throughout history, like, leaders had to be, you know, like, not weak.
Yeah,
right.
These are all fine arguments, but there's zero ability to evaluate whether or not either one of us are right, because we cannot test these hypotheses in an experiment.
Right. But if we're asking why do men not show these things? I'm telling you why. Because it's not encouraged societally, right?
Right.
Culturally, it's not encouraged.
Yeah. And we don't know why that is. We just know that it is.
A hypothesis.
And you have an hypothesis that you could never test.
Well, I can test.
And the reason why I have a problem with people making, quote unquote, the naturalistic argument is because when they do that, I think it further shames men, essentially, or further shames whoever might be shamed by that statement.
Why?
Because you're saying essentially that it's a natural urge or a natural reaction to someone crying. It's in our blood. It's in our DNA.
No, I'm actually letting us off the hook. I'm saying.
I know that
it's
that's
okay.
Not, I know
it's
that's
okay
not
that
what
it was
you're
like
saying.
That.
I know that's not that what you're saying.
Yeah.
But that's how it's used in the general public. So the more we divorce from the naturalistic argument, the DNA evolution argument, in my mind, the better we are able to change our culture. You get at someone on Fox News that's talking about, well, men are supposed to be the we evolved to earn the money. We evolved to, and the women evolved to take care of the children. Well, they use those evolutionary psychology BS arguments to promote their political agenda.
Yeah, but you could take it to the extreme, like saying, like, look, we can't even claim that men on average, and I know the bell curve, but on average, have bodies that are larger and more muscle mass. We can't even claim that. Therefore, we can't even acknowledge that we're starting
that.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. And that is an evolutionary result, right?
Absolutely.
I'm saying, I think it helps us more than it hurts us to say, okay, you know what? It makes sense that we are like this because of where we're coming from, but now we have a chance to change our behaviors and our society in spite
Great.
Of that.
And if that's the way people used evolutionary psychology, I'd be cool with that. Mm-hmm. I would still refute the statement on a scientific basis because I would say...
Well, you'd want to see the evidence, but I also want to see the counter evidence, right?
There is no evidence or counter, or very little anyway, because that's the nature that... I have argued so many people about evolutionary psychology ever since I released my evolutionary psychology episodes, which I did not also think would create so much controversy on the internet. I realize that there are people, mainly on the internet, that are very pro-evolutionary psychology. And I have had so many arguments with people, particularly when they also are the super anti-feminist people. There's a certain kind of Venn diagram of people on the internet, and there's a group of people that are super pro evolutionary psychology, and there's a good portion of them that are also super anti-feminism. And when I talk about culture, I sometimes end up talking about feminism. And then I get these very, very abusive emails from people. And my point here is that on a scientific basis, they are utilizing the science and the scientists' arguments to make what I am claiming to be very spurious arguments.
Well, yeah, you're saying that it gets abused. But I also, I sometimes feel from our discussions that we shouldn't even make a hypothesis and try to test it. But I know that that's not what you're saying, right? Like, if I want to make a hypothesis, I should be able to test it. Why don't we look at the DNA? Let's look at let's look at genetics and let's see if we can make some sense out of things.
And let's go down those roads. And people are.
Yeah.
But what often is done in these studies is these researchers, these authors are encouraged, shall we say, to draw a firm conclusion mm-hmm. rather than saying, you know what, we studied it, we have very light evidence going in this direction, but it could be totally wrong. No one writes like that in evolutionary psychology anyway, or very few people do.
Yeah.
What they say is, and this demonstrates blank. This demonstrates that men evolved. Let me give you an example. You know, men's penises, human male penises, are odd in one way. Do you know how they're odd?
Well, they're the largest primate penis.
Right. But what's another odd feature of the penis?
I don't know.
It has a head.
Oh, okay.
Like a little head.
Okay.
A weird little... I don't know what you call it.
It's thicker and wider at the top.
Yeah. But it's like suddenly.
I see.
It's not like a bulbous. It's like a sudden ledge.
Yes.
There's like a ledge.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Other penises typically don't have that. It's typically just a tube, which makes more sense because, you know, mechanically you're trying to get in, you know, anyway. So guess what the evolutionary psychologists will say as a hypothesis as to why that exists?
Well, you mean like biologists, like evolutionary biologists?
But it's also, to some extent, evolutionary psychology.
Okay, so my guess, if one was making a thing, it would be like similar. Maybe it'd be similar to the dog, how the dog penis gets stuck. Maybe I'd say, hey, you know, having the head makes it so that it's actually, once it's inside, it's a little harder to pull out easier. And you can kind of, you know, expect that they can have sex for just long enough to ejaculate.
Can you say that SSV?
Cuando estás penetrando y tienes...
That's not sexy voice. That's just Spanish voice. You got to do sexy Spanish voice.
But that, cuando estás penetrando y estás muy, muy hondo y tienes esa cabeza de amor.
Yeah. So let me tell you the argument that is being made by some. They say that it's because our early ancestors were rapists... And this head will scoop out the...
Oh, yeah, I've heard that too, yes.
The,
right.
The semen from the previous. So it proves that in our early days, women were routinely raped by multiple or had sex, you know, multiple men would have sex with women when they were ovulating. And that this scooper would help with that. So
that's the evidence there.
Yeah. So zero evidence is given.
Yeah.
It's just someone's fantastical imagination. Now, it's possible, but these are typically the things that get the headlines.
But so there's a huge difference because that's not observable, right?
A lot of things are not observable.
I mean, okay, let me rephrase. You could potentially test whether or not a penis head tends to scoop out semen from a vagina or not, right? You could test that. That's one test.
Yeah.
You could also look at cultures to see if there is a rape type culture and primitive culture. You could do all these kind of like side experiments and then maybe
the experiment would be a scoop.
Yeah.
The cultural
observations. You could do observations.
Yeah.
But yeah, I see. But it's very different. Like, it's very different to look around and see what do people respect? Do people respect like, you know, cry, or do people respect like, oh, that guy's stoic. He says he's going to go kick their ass and bomb them with nukes. Okay. We're voting for
that
guy.
But that person exists within a socio-historical culture.
But then
context.
You can read history, and it seems like it's been there as long as we've been writing history.
History is not a accurate depiction of the way people are. One, two, they also exist in a culture.
Absolutely, you think I'm only tying it to some DNA allele? What I'm saying is that at some point, we culturally evolved to prefer leaders that were stoic.
Which is not the same as evolutionary psychology.
But okay, fair enough. I am not claiming myself to be an evolutionary psychologist. But I am saying that at some point, it was advantageous for people to be like, oh, I see, I need to be stoic because that's what they seem to respect. And then that became the selective thing for men too, right?
Well,
and so all of a sudden, we have a whole bunch of men trying to be stoic, but not necessarily being able to be stoic, and then they have the conflict, right?
Well, let me ask you this. So let's take, you know, 100 babies, we put them in a biodome, mm-hmm. and we let them raise themselves. Do you think that the boys that grow up in the biodome will be as stoic as our culture wants them to be?
I don't know.
I'm going to guess no. I'm just going to take a guess without any adults telling them how they should or should not feel about their emotions. Again, I can't prove this, but it seems like a guess of mine that they would cry, that the boys and the girls would both cry normally when they felt like crying, and that it wouldn't be hampered by culture. So, because evolutionary psychology would say that the boys in that biodome will become like us because they are born that way.
Well,
now, the cultural people will say that we teach ourselves to do that and we're socialized to do that. So you're making two things. You're saying we're socialized and we have the DNA that programs the brain to behave in a certain way. And I say that it's really hard to differentiate between those two things. And trying to discuss this on the internet with some boo who calls me a mangina is extremely frustrating.
I guess I will agree with you that it's clear, it's obvious, and this can be demonstrated through examples, that the DNA portion of our being isn't 100% in line with the cultural expectations.
That's a nonsensical sentence.
No.
The DNA in line.
It's not at all. The DNA.
We have no idea how the DNA alone, if we can take a fly, okay?
Wait, did you understand what I said? I'm saying that I can show you an example of how a man is not able to live up to the societal expectations in spite of being made of DNA that is theoretically evolved and blah, blah. Therefore, that's one counterexample, and I can find millions and millions in this world to show that, well, okay, clearly not everyone's DNA seems to match the societal expectations about what it means to be a, quote, man, right? So this actually adds proof on your side, which is, or counterproof, to say, hey, you know what? Not everyone's DNA seems to automatically make them this way or that way, right?
I don't even know what you're saying. DNA makes them?
Yeah. So like, basically, it's kind of like the, imagine if someone was making the argument like, look, we've evolved to be heterosexual. Well, no, I can find a lot of counterexamples, right? In the same way, to say, hey, listen, men have evolved to be stoic. Well, I can find a lot of counterexamples, right? But it doesn't mean the DNA hasn't been affected by the societies in the last hundred thousands of years.
Doesn't mean impossible to prove at this point.
Well, not impossible. We don't have good tests for it.
We have maybe we'll figure something out in the future.
I mean, they're sequencing faster and faster, right?
But sequencing is not the answer. Sequencing is not the answer.
Well, it's part of the answer.
No. It's a very, very small part of it.
But we're going to find, because, you know, we know.
You can sequence, and this is the problem with people on the internet, is you can sequence a DNA, and you can say, okay, this codes for dark hair or light hair.
Yeah.
And you take a mouse and you switch the genes and you go, oh, this one does dark hair, this one does light hair.
Right.
Great. To code for the brain, imagine the codes that go into making a brain.
Right.
Imagine the developmental conditions that make a brain in the woman's womb. Imagine the conditions that make a brain develop socially.
Right.
For 20 years, 25 years as a person, as a human being develops. Now imagine tying a behavior like whether one cries or not to DNA.
Yeah.
That is a very difficult, we can't take a gene and switch it out and go, okay, that person cries a lot and that person never cries.
Totally, totally.
That's not, it's a nonsensical thing to tie it directly to DNA because our brains are not only determined by DNA.
Absolutely. But it's not nonsensical. And it's not happening in the next 10 years. But we already have more and more increasingly accurate maps of the brain. So we understand the regions that are predetermined versus we're going to be understanding more and more the regions that are predetermined.
I'll even argue against that. We have extremely rudimentary science regarding that. We're definitely making some advances.
Right.
Absolutely.
But there are regions of the brain that are there at birth.
200 years from now, they're going to look back at us and think we were in the Stone Ages.
Totally fair. But there are regions that are there at birth that are not societally influenced.
Stone Age. It's not ages, by the way.
Stone Age.
So an article recently came out, and it was completely buried, and there were a number of our top thinkers – Noam Chomsky, we've heard of him, and a bunch of other very well-known philosophers, scientists about language and about evolution and this sort of thing. And what they determined after reviewing all the research and all the philosophy regarding speech development, because there's a big debate in neuroscience and speech science regarding why humans develop speech. We're the only animals, aside from whales and some other animals, that have extremely limited speech, right, or communication regarding that. We just have this humongous capacity for syntax and meaning and, you know, tens of thousands of words and blah, blah, blah. And so it's like, did we evolve that, or did it pop out of some other evolutionary process, you know? Did we evolve some other capacity that just morphed into language and then we just sort of benefited from it? You know, it's there's a lot of debate around that. And these people, after reviewing the literature for their entire careers, by the way, because this is Noam Chomsky's big thing, is they determined that there is no way to know the answer to that question at this point, given our science in 2014. This is when it was written. They put out a statement and said, we cannot, through evolution, through science, determine whether or not we even evolved the capacity for speech. This is a major part of the human condition, whether or not we talk. There are parts of the brain that are very specific that they've mapped out, and they still can't figure out whether or not we evolved speech or whether or not it just came out of some other capacity. This I loved, and I wished it was, but it doesn't get any headlines because it's not sexy. Because another article will come out and say, scientists prove that we evolved speech in order to kill our neighbors or something. You know what I mean? And that will get a headline. And so I read this article like 10 times. I was just like, yes, these people are my people because they see that our current science is just too limited to answer big questions like, you know, did we evolve stoicism in men? Those are too big of questions to answer, and we cannot answer those scientifically today.
I think this is part of the difference, is that we are not, how do I say this? So there's a difference between saying we can prove that through DNA, through natural selection, we evolved to be stoic. Okay, that's one of these things that's like super impossible to prove right now with our science. Right, totally. I agree with that. A different thing is to say, hey, look, through current observations from historical observations, meaning reading all the historical accounts from all these tribes and generations and blah, 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 it seems that there's a pattern that leaders and people prefer to follow people that seem to have these characteristics, right? And we can draw our little Venn diagram and say, oh, I see, these characteristics seem to be the common ones. Okay. And then you can conclude something like, all right, humans in our society and in the last societies we can read about seem to prefer these characteristics.
Great.
Right. And then you can just say, like, well, it's not surprising that today we are like this because for the last 2,000 years, we've been preferring these things.
I am a billion percent behind you, infinity percent behind what you just said.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, what people do is they jump to biology with their next sentence.
Right.
And that's when I have a problem.
Yeah. Okay.
Because there's no way
I think
we're
on the same
page.
I understand now where you're coming from.
Yeah. And that's when I get in these arguments with people because they're just like, so you're saying like men don't benefit from being stoic if leaders? And I'm saying, no, I'm just saying you can't prove that that has anything to do with biology. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, listener Chris says, I am a counselor in Denver and enjoy listening to your podcasts. Dr. Honda. Not Dr. Kirk Honda. Dr. Honda, you were discussing shame and how people should feel shame. Oh, yeah, this is a good email, actually. Dr. Honda, you were discussing shame and how some people, quote unquote, should feel shame. So just to give Berto, you a background from what I was saying on the podcast was that sometimes with clients, they will talk about shame. And I find the shame that they're talking about to be counterproductive and really destructive to their self-esteem and depression and self-worth and all these things. And so I end up getting into a debate with them about how to view certain behaviors that they think are very shameful. And so, you know, I'll say, well, it sounds like you're having a lot of shame. And I'm like, yeah, well, what are you ashamed of? And they'll say, well, I can't seem to get this project done at work, or I'm 30 years old and I'm not married yet. You know, every relationship I've been in has been a failure, or I went to college and graduate school, and I'm still working at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course I'm ashamed of myself. And it's common for therapists to say, no, you shouldn't be ashamed of that. There's nothing to be ashamed of.
Interesting.
There's nothing to be ashamed of in that. If you want to change your situation, then go for it. But to be ashamed of it, to let it drag you down self-esteem-wise and self-worth-wise, that's not fair to you. That's beating yourself up. So that's a common therapist thing that I do and that other therapists do. What I usually follow it up with clients, because I follow it up with, I say, but that's not to say that there's nothing you should be ashamed of, because shame is a good emotion sometimes. And the reason why I point this out is because if I just say you should never feel ashamed for anything,
yeah, it's not right.
Then some clients are going to look at me like, well, now you're just being ridiculous.
Of course,
you know, it's sort of like you go to your mom when you're a kid and you're like, you know, I screwed up in school and I said something stupid and now I'm humiliated. And your mom says, you wouldn't do that. You're perfect. Right. It's, you look at your mom and you're like,
okay, then
you
lose credibility.
I can't believe anything you say now. So I say, now, having said that, shame is an important emotion. It actually does help us sometimes, because there are some things you should actually feel ashamed of. Like if you run over a puppy on purpose.
Yeah.
If I have a puppy and it's out, you know, if it's, and you kill it on purpose, you should be ashamed of that. Your self-worth should go down, because that's a terrible thing that you did.
Yeah.
And that should help you to not ever do that again.
Right.
So I say that. And then in the Men's Shame episode, I pointed that out. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I can't agree more, because as you were saying, you know, I was thinking to myself, well, hold on. There's definitely some things, because I was thinking like, yeah, luckily I don't feel shame about things that I'm unhappy, because there's things about myself that I'm definitely unhappy about that I want to change, but I never feel shame about them. But I have felt shame in my life. And when I felt shame, it's because I did something bad, quote unquote, and I regret it. And I feel for the people that were affected by it.
Right.
For example, I've been very drunk before in my life. And when I have been, sometimes I've done things that the next day or at least 2 days later, I was like, oh my God, I really should not have said that. I really should not have done that.
And the other
and
person,
I feel shame.
And the person was actually hurt by it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I feel shame.
You're not just beating yourself up. The other person was hurt by it.
Exactly. And like you're saying, it's partially that feeling of shame that makes me not want to maybe repeat that behavior the next time.
So the vast majority of situations that I hear, if not all, honestly, of people shaming themselves are in the category of, in my view, it's unreasonable to feel shame in that situation. You know, the examples I gave. So anyway, I said that in the episode, and this person is responding to that. So she says, however, the population that I work with, this is a therapist in Denver, the population, this is a therapist, she says, the population that I work with are men and women who have participated in abortion in some way, either having one themselves or in a relationship with someone who has had an abortion. The main issue that I come across with this population is the incredible debilitating shame that holds people back from participating in life, relationships, parenting, etc. We work together to heal that shame, mostly by way of support groups. This is the shame that keeps the topic in such secrecy, in the dark and unhealed. Please be cautious. This is her telling me. Please be cautious when using murder as an example, either on the podcast or in session, because you never know if someone is listening or a client has had an abortion and has been told that they are the lowest of the low because they murdered a fetus. Any thoughts on that?
So
to back up, I gave the puppy example, but I also gave the example of if you murdered someone in cold blood on purpose, then you should be ashamed of that.
So here's the problem I have is that just because some people use a label in a bad way should not remove your ability to use the label in the right way. And so to put it on the murder side, it's like, man, the way we define murder is you took a premeditated course of action that ended someone's life that was by law or by our common standards entitled to the same protections you are, and you invaded their freedom and killed them, right? And when
you can see how that for some people could be applied to abortion.
But of course it can, and it should if it is past the points that we have agreed on. Because if we say, well, this person killed their newborn baby, well, yeah, that is bad. But if you say, well, this person had an abortion at the ninth month or almost right before birth, well, we've agreed that actually that's not okay either. But if you had an abortion in the range that we as a society have agreed is not murder, then it's not murder.
Yeah.
Right? And it is really just the definition. It's an agreement.
Yeah. I mean, right. Well, the first time I read this email, I had a similar thought. I thought, well, I wasn't talking about abortion. I was talking about murdering someone like an adult in cold blood. I wasn't talking about abortion. That was the furthest thing from my mind. And I would never shame someone for having an abortion. It's a personal choice that people have to make. And the ethics and the morality regarding such an act is, I believe, very personal and up to everyone to decide how they want to decide upon it.
But except with the caveat that it's predicated upon a scientific and societal agreement about at which point that becomes not okay.
Well, I don't want to get into the debate regarding quote-unquote scientific definition of a human versus a fetus or a group of cells.
We are lucky that we don't have to, but people have had to have that discussion.
Right. That's not really a topic of this pod. Well, we could talk about it another time perhaps, but anyway.
But you see, it's hard to even talk about abortion without acknowledging that there is a definition of abortion.
And so this reminds me of, did you see the news story recently about Bud Light? They said it's one of their Did you hear their advertising?
Yeah, it was because they have like up for anything, right? That's their big thing. So they were saying like this, you know, on the beer can, it said something like "remove no from your vocabulary" or something like that.
Yeah, drink this and it will remove no from your vocabulary.
Right.
And as soon as I heard the news on that, I thought, oh my God, you idiots. Because in our culture,
it was very unwise.
Yeah, I understand the spirit of what they were saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes total sense. You're just being like, you're adding yes to your category.
That's right.
And you're saying yes to things and you're having fun and you're not being a downer.
Yeah.
Well, in our culture right now, the word no, removing it from your vocabulary, and booze
is not a good association,
are absolutely associated with date rape and these sorts of things. And to have that phrase, which albeit came from, I'm sure, a totally innocent, in fact, a very positive place.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 60s and early 70s, there was a big thing about yes, like the Beatles, you know?
Yep.
Like the Yellow Submarine.
Yeah.
Yeah, John fell in love with Yoko because he climbed the ladder and at the top there was a magnifying glass and he looks through it and it just said yes on the ceiling and he fell in love with Yoko. Yeah. So there's this big thing around yes. I totally get that as a hippie. My inner hippie likes that phrase in the Bud Light can. And the debate is like, well, you know, people on the right are like, well, we have to be PC about everything now. And people on the left are like, oh, it promotes rape culture. And the thing to me is like, well, what it does is it looks like you're being insensitive about what we are currently talking about in our society right now. My guess is in 20 years from now, you could have a phrase like that because we'll have evolved in some way culturally,
right,
that you could have a phrase like that and it will mean something different.
Yeah, for me, it's slightly different. I don't feel offended and I don't feel they're being insensitive. I feel they're being, it's bad business. I feel they're being bad marketers.
Right.
Because they should have known that a reaction was going to happen.
Right.
And if they knew that reaction was going to happen and they wanted that publicity, then of course now we're offended.
I'm sure.
But I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. No one wants Bud Light to be associated with date rape.
No.
You know what I mean?
That would have been very bad.
Yeah. They're trying to be associated with fun and
I am surprised that in the brainstorming, I'm hoping someone raised their hand and is now going, I told you so.
So here's my thought on that. My guess is, and again, this is total just guesswork, is that they are, you know, and these aren't beer drinking people, they're advertisers. These are marketers.
Yeah.
It's, you know, our vision is like, oh, they're a bunch of beer drinking.
No, they drink martinis.
Yeah. But these are executives and they're often young people too.
Yeah.
So, and they're trying to, Bud Light's trying to appeal to young people. So I guarantee you that young people were consulted on that. And my guess is that they were just lost in their heads, you know?
Well,
They were brainstorming and someone came up with this idea and it made sense. And what they didn't think of is when we put this on a can and it goes on the shelf, and it goes to literally millions, if not billions of people, how many of them are going to look at this with, you know, a sideways glance? You know, how many people are going to look at this a little funny? And they just didn't run that through their filter.
No, but I gotta say that, like, there's no way, because look, I've been in big companies and stuff, and there's no way that there wasn't a super long email trail about this. And including the discussion as to whether or not there's a risk that people could interpret it. And I guarantee you there was a long discussion at some point, and it ended up net-net, it's probably not a big risk.
But
I guarantee
these things do get brought up. That's interesting. I could see that. But if that happened, they're idiots.
Because mistakes are made.
Because it's not that great of a phrase. So, like, why would you get married to that? Plus, it was one of like 100 different phrases they were using. Anyway, my point is that when I use the word murder and shame, there's a certain group of people that might really resonate with. People who have been had an abortion or had a partner that had an abortion.
Yeah.
And for them, saying you should be ashamed if you murdered somebody might be insensitive in that same way. That to me, I'm coming from a completely different place.
But you'd have to caveat it every time. You just can't. I mean, we just can't all of a sudden say, "Look, murder is fine." And no, murder is a word that has meaning, and murder is not okay, and it is shameful.
Right. But you understand what I'm saying, right?
I do understand what you're saying.
Because right now, there are some Bud Light executives going, we can't let the PC police dictate what we do. We have to stand up. You know, they're saying the same things you are.
Yeah, but for the wrong side of the fence. They're on the side of like, we should be able to say up for whatever with alcohol equals. But I'm saying murder is wrong.
Right. But the bigger argument that might be made on this side of the fence is I should be able to use the word murder and shame in the way that I think it's constructed and have that be okay because it's how I construct it without considering the fact that a small pocket of people might be really hurt by that statement. And could I use different words essentially? Now, and in my head, I'm thinking there are a lot of different other phrases or if different construct or different situations I can use that might not be that might not hurt someone, like killing a puppy, for instance. I'm guessing that doesn't, I don't know, no one's sent me any emails regarding that.
Well, here's an example. Let's say that we said, listen, if you were a racist or if you're a racist, you should feel shame about that. Let's say for a second, right?
Yeah.
If you are a racist, you should feel shame about that. Well, as you may have seen over the recent rioting in Baltimore, there's a lot of people that unfortunately hold the opinion that those rioters are racist because they hate all white people, okay? And not only the rioters, the protesters, like those people, they're racist. They hate all white people. Okay. So, you know, you can imagine the same kind of sensitivity. No, you can't say racist. Racism is shameful.
Well,
because people get called racist that aren't, and they shouldn't feel shame.
Totally. I wouldn't use that example because I'm racist. I was born and raised in a racist society and have racist innate elements in my reactivity towards other people. I actively try to fight against it and accommodate, you know, and account for it. I'm never perfect in it, but I really try. So to say that one would be ashamed to be racist. Now, should someone be ashamed if they purposely hurt someone through racism? We could say that, right? And that would be hard to misconstrue.
Yeah, I guess I just keep going back to like I mean, we cannot, if the word, let me put it a different way. Are we saying that someone who has a legal, law-protected abortion is a murderer? No, we're not saying that.
No, but some people.
And those some people do not get to dictate the meaning of murder.
But even the people who had the abortion will sometimes be on the fence as to whether or not they murdered someone.
Right. But we cannot let real murderers off the hook just because some people feel that they are murderers.
Right. And another way of looking at it is that you and I have a privilege in terms of that word doesn't hurt us.
Right.
And it does hurt them.
Yeah.
And so we can fling the word around as much as we want.
But you could take abortion out of the picture and just say, look, I was in an accident. I was in a shooting range and there was an accident and a thing happened and a person died. It wasn't my fault. I wasn't trying to kill them. And I served, you know, 6 months of community service, and I feel so much shame about that. And you could make almost the same argument. It's like, well, then, you know, when you said that murder is wrong and you should feel shame, I feel that shame and I still feel that shame. It's like, well, no, dude, that's not a murder. You were convicted of involuntary manslaughter and blah, 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 blah. But you cannot all of a sudden say, you're right, we cannot shame murderers. But no, that's not fair.
Yeah. I agree, you know, for the most part. The other part of it is I agree with the emailer in that whenever I am alerted to certain language that hurts people, I try to adjust my behavior. All right, one more email. Listener Zoe says, I absolutely love this podcast. I was wondering if perhaps you do one on agoraphobia or panic disorder. Well, as I read that, I realize we don't really have time to do that. But actually, yeah, our co-host Paulette suffers from anxiety, and she would love to talk about it. So we will definitely do that. And I think I'll do an episode soon on different kinds of phobias and different approaches to it.
So that makes me a little worried because I'm afraid of doing episodes about phobias.
Well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us on this email journey. Please take care of yourself.
Should we sing a Yes song?
In and around the about.
What's the one Yes song?
You don't know that song?
I know the one Yes song. What's that one song? Move yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Move down the bridge of light. Never thinking about the future.
Yeah.
Free yourself. Give them the free will a chance. Owner of a lonely heart. Knew much better than owner of a lonely... Oh, no. Owner of a broken heart. Yeah. Owner of a lonely heart is much better than an owner of a broken heart.
Why?
Because... Wait. No. Owner of a broken heart is much better... I can't remember which one's better.
It's better to have lived and loved than to never...
Owner of a lonely heart is much better than owner of a broken heart. Owner of a lonely heart is better than an owner of a broken heart.
Oh, I don't even know. I never even paid attention.
Oh my gosh, what is it? One of them makes sense. One of them doesn't. What's the song called? Owner of a Lonely Heart? Owner of a Lonely Heart. Lyrics. Why doesn't the Google result just show me lyrics to begin with? Damn it. All right. Okay, here we go. Shake! Shake yourself! Open.
The song describes the paradox of loneliness. Once you've been hurt, loneliness is better than a broken heart.
Yeah, it is. So owner of a lonely heart, much better than an owner of a broken heart. I disagree.
And that does it for another episode.
Bye.